So this talk is about cryptography in a quantum world. Quantum computers are this are basically a theoretical model. You know, they reflect our physicists' current understanding of quantum mechanics. It's kind of the best model we have going. If that understanding is correct, then it might be possible to construct large-scale quantum computers which manipulate information in a very different way from the way we're used to thinking about it. And the question is, how does the kind of landscape of computer science look given this, you know, in this kind of world? And specifically, I'm interested in cryptography. So by and large, you know, new features appear. There are new difficulties which arise, also things that go away. There are large pieces that remain more or less unchanged. And by and large, what's needed are a set of tools and some new language for reasoning about cryptography and quantum adversaries. And the field is still very young. There are some successes, maybe more than occasional mistakes and lots of interesting questions. So this is a one slide version of the talk. If you go to sleep now, you it'll be okay. All right, so what are some of the things that can't change? Well, we know about unconditional key exchange, factoring and discrete log are basically are no longer hard. So protocols based on their specific properties kind of don't work anymore. There are surprisingly some weak two-party primitives which can be realized unconditionally. So a sort of a weakened version of coin flipping, a weakened version of string commitment. Other weird things happen. There are multi-prover commitment schemes which are secure against classical provers but not against quantum provers, because they can introduce sort of weird correlations that don't necessarily have a classical. So these are classical schemes where all the communication is classical. The honest prover strategy is classical, but a pair of cheating quantum provers can break the scheme. Other things. So some extractors fail to work in the quantum model. So the meaning of quantum sort of conditional entropy and things like that changes. It's very different, and there are situations where our intuition about classical information theoretic objects is actually false. Some of them are okay, so Koenig, Moore, and Renner showed that they're basically pairwise independent extractors still do work, but then where the line is between things that do work and don't work, no one really knows. Another interesting thing, some simulators for zero-knowledge proofs fail. Sometimes new ones can be built, and there was a very elegant and simple result of John Watcher's that appeared in Stock this year, for example, that was built a simulator for the basic three-round zero-knowledge proof systems, but there are many questions left there. The bounded storage model behaves very differently, in fact, much more realistically, and it's significantly more powerful in the quantum model. And on my webpage, I have a survey talk I gave, oddly enough, in Los Angeles last year, and I've got a pile of references, so if you're interested, you can go look at those.
What do you mean by sound simulators for zero knowledge fail?
So basically, the normal way you would try to rewind zero knowledge simulators, and I'll say more about this later, doesn't work. It's not clear that it's insecure, that the protocols are, it's not clear the protocols are not zero knowledge.
Deliberate against quantum distinguishers?
Quantum verifiers in that case. Yeah. Okay, so this talk is, I'll talk about like I'll give you a sort of a partial list of salient features in this new landscape. Partial means two things in English, both incomplete and biased, and it'll be both. So I'll talk about multi-party quantum computing. So imagine sort of like the usual multi-party computing setting. Parties hold quantum inputs. They want to evaluate a quantum circuit. So this is a strict generalization of the classical problem. And I'll discuss two feasibility results. So first of all, statistically secure protocols exist if and only if the minority of the players in the protocol are dishonest. So this is a result, this is assuming a broadcast channel, so it's essentially the quantum analog of a result of Robin and Ben-Hur. And a result I probably won't talk about very much is that computational multi-party computationally secure protocols exist for an adversary who can corrupt an arbitrary subsets of cheaters. And this is sort of the quantum analog of the GMW 87 result. And it holds in its current form under a somewhat non-standard assumption. So this bullet is somewhat more nebulously defined than the first one, and I'll spend most of the time on the first one. Okay, so along the way, we'll see some infeasibility results. We'll learn a little bit about how do you authenticate quantum states and the bizarre nature of approximate error correction with quantum information. And given time, I'll talk a little bit about zero knowledge proofs of knowledge. Okay. So this is more structured outline. I'll give a couple of slides on some basic notions in quantum computing. I'll try and keep the notation very light. I'll define or sketch, explain the problem in the of multi-party quantum computing and the big statements. As I said, most of the time will be spent trying to look at sort of quantum error correction and authenticating quantum states and the way these two things interact. And then I'll explain some ideas behind two protocols for quantum. Okay, so quantum information, the model is different. In this model, as you may have heard, if I want to describe a quantum system that's in isolation, it's in what's called a pure state, and this is described by a vector in some complex space. The basic unit of quantum information is a two-dimensional system called a qubit. So here you have two basis vectors, 0 and 1, that correspond to the classical states, the classical bits. And then the state of a qubit in isolation is described by some complex linear combination of these two states, and for simplicity, we'll just generally normalize to 1. Okay, so a qubit sort of lies somewhere on this complex ball, and if I want to describe a larger system, a register of n qubits, then I get, in general, some linear combination of the 2 to the n possible classical states of the system. And this allows me to describe a set of n qubits that are isolated from the rest of the universe. But notice that because the qubits within the register are not isolated, a qubit-by-qubit description is not enough. And a proof of this is the fact that if I wanted to describe a qubit-by-qubit, I could use 2n numbers. And here, in this formalism, I can use 2 to the n numbers. Okay, obviously, it's not a real proof, but yeah.
Do you mean that alpha and beta are complex numbers?
Complex numbers, yeah, sorry. Again, because of the computer switch, this is element of the complexes. Okay, these are two symbols that are lying on top of each other.
Okay, but then, why are they complex?
Why are they complex?
Yeah,
so it turns out that drawing the two-dimensional complex plane is a bit of a pain, and so I just stuck with the real version. But for many, many things, it turns out the complex formalism gives you more power, but for many, many things, real coefficients are sufficient. And if you don't like fields where -1 has a square root, then you can safely ignore the complex component, especially for this topic. Okay, there's really going to be minimal use of this kind of technique, this level of detail. I keep on pressing the wrong button. Okay, so how do we operate on quantum states? Well, in general, quantum circuits can be represented as combinations of two kinds of gates. There are invertible operations, which are called, which are described by unitary matrices. So these are just linear operators on the space that preserve the norm. Okay, and it's not the case that all quantum operations are invertible. It's simply the case that you can always represent a circuit as a combination of invertible steps followed by something destructive, such as a measurement. So an example of a measurement is where you ask this qubit a sort of Republican style with us or against us question, you know, are you zero or are you one? You can't be anywhere in between. And the qubit will decide, depending on these two coefficients, whether it wants to be zero or one. And this is destructive. From then on, the state of the system is either zero or one once it's been measured. Okay, so one of the most important things that comes out of this is called information versus disturbance. So you can't learn about a general quantum system without somehow disturbing it. So this is an important principle of quantum mechanics. And in this particular formalism, it can be represented very simply. So it's usually called no cloning, and I'll just use this logo to remind you of it occasionally throughout the talk. So imagine we have a state that goes through some quantum circuit which outputs two systems, A and B. Then the theorem is that if A reproduces the input faithfully, then B is independent of the input. So if A is a copy of psi for all input psi, okay, so it has to work in general. If the box works in general, then B never carries any information at all. Okay. And in fact, you can generalize this. You can say that under an appropriate notion of information, that if this is one unit of information, then each of these, the information in A and B sums to one. Okay. So there's a sort of this notion scales well. But what does it mean? So it means if I learn about a system, then I must necessarily disturb it in general. And for cryptography, the converse is possibly the more interesting statement. If I've got a system which I can either guarantee is error-free, or if I can test for errors, then it gives me, and I can test and see that no disturbance occurred, then it tells me that that no information was leaked. So resilience to errors somehow implies secrecy, and that's a useful thing to remember. And somehow the meta theme for the talk is the way that this principle kind of plays out in a few situations.
Yeah. I think I understand the second implication, but I don't understand the first. What do you mean information applies to
storage? So, again, look at this picture. If B contained any information at all about the input, then A would not be a faithful copy.
Okay.
Okay, so what is it? So if imagine B is, you know, the system held by some adversary, Yevgeny, and he's not even here. and A is what's held by the good guys. Then if Yevgeny learns anything, the good guys may have a chance of noticing, or will have in general have a chance of noticing.
That's what you mean by disturbance.
Disturbing means changing the state. Yeah.
Our final test of resilience, doesn't it disturb the system?
Yeah. I mean, this is a somewhat oversimplified. I mean, okay. This is going to be a mix of a Hotech talk. Okay, so yeah, you know, yes, to testing for disturbance in general is hard, and doing it right is tricky. But this is I mean this bullet at a very fluffy level. I mean, okay, just a very intuitive statement, and we'll see concrete instantiations of how that plays out. But if you want to think about it mathematically, I think this is the right way to do it. Okay, so I said, so that was the crash course on quantum computing, and basically that's the extent of formalism we'll need. All right, so what is multi-party computation? You've all heard this before. You know, we've got a bunch of players. They send inputs to some trusted party all the trusted party does is it runs some circuit, right? And then at the end, it passes the outputs of the circuit back to the players. And what we'd like is that even if some subset of the players are cheating, then the protocol will behave indistinguishably. Will still behave indistinguishably from this classical circuit, and in the following sense, that you can build a simulator such that the cheaters can't tell the difference between the ideal world and the real the protocol. And for this talk, the resource of interest here is the number of honest players in the protocol. So this is kind of what I'll look at. So you know, back to the late 1980s in terms of classical crypto. All right, so what's the quantum version of this? Well, it's basically the same idea. Each player now holds a quantum state as his input, and he doesn't need to necessarily know a description of the quantum state, he just needs to have his hands on it. And this includes the adversary. So the cheaters, you know, get sort of their own quantum inputs, which they may not have created themselves. They may have been given by some distinguisher. Okay, now, and then there's some trusted quantum circuit. In the ideal world, there's a trusted quantum circuit which is evaluated on all these inputs, and then the various pieces of the quantum circuit are passed out to the people as the various outputs of the quantum circuit are handed off to the various people as appropriate. And what we'd like is the same sort of notion of security. We can build a simulator such that some distinguisher who gets to interact with either, he gets to control the cheaters in their interaction with the ideal protocol, or the cheaters in their interaction with the real protocol, he won't be able to tell the difference. Okay, so like a UC-style definition of security. So this generalizes classical secure function evaluation, but new techniques are needed. So for example, players can't keep copies of their input. Okay, so this is, again, the no cloning gets in the way. So a lot of, you know, one of the basic techniques in classical protocols is you sort of commit to some values and you remember what you committed to, and then you prove statements about that, remembering what exactly you have to prove. So players can't keep copies of their inputs. Rewinding may not be possible for the same reason that basically when you rewind, you're running a circuit many times, and if you think of an adversary who's getting auxiliary information from a distinguisher, then each time you run the adversary circuit, you may be disturbing or somehow destroying the distinguisher's input, and so the distinguisher, again, may notice. Finally, you know, one of the problems that comes along with this is somehow we need to find ways of operating on either encoded or encrypted quantum states, just like the way we can do in the classical system.
So you're saying players cannot keep copies of their input, but if the players know their input, then they can make as many quantum states out of it as they want.
If they know a classical description of their input, so if I mean, there's a big difference between having something, a quantum state for which you know a description from a quantum state for which you do not. So if you know the description, then you can prepare many copies. But in general, you don't. Especially, and this really, if you should think about it in terms of, if you want to think about it in terms of composability. If you want to modularly build up protocols, then as you're moving through a protocol, you may not know exactly what it is you've got your hands on at a given stage. Okay, because it depends on interactions with many other people, blah, blah, blah. Yeah?
I have a hard time understanding what's going on in the real world, actually. I mean, they're not doing classical bits, right?
This is a theory of cryptography workshop.
No. I mean, what's the model? Like the model is that two people can just intertwine states or something?
I'm sorry. So, what's the real world model? Yeah, I should have explained. So imagine we've got a bunch of quantum computers. So, you know, labs spread out throughout the world with their respective quantum computers, and then they're connected by, you know, by fiber or some by quantum channel. So they can
do a photon with some state. Okay.
Yeah. Let's pretend you can reliably send me. You can reliably send and store and process quantum states.
So what's broadcast?
Broadcast means classical broadcast.
Classical bits.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so because quantum states are kind of hard to sometimes think about or play with, you know, very often you have your sort of quantum information and then classical information alongside. And like if you want to ensure consistency, you can't broadcast a quantum state, but you can certainly broadcast a classical state to make sure you're all starting the protocol, you know, this kind of thing.
So essentially you cannot do the broadcast of quantum state.
It's just not defined.
Well, by no cloning, you can't really.
Sorry?
By no cloning, you couldn't.
exactly.
That's what I mean. Yeah, it's just it doesn't make sense to broadcast a conversation. Yeah.
What about entanglement between Alice and Bob? Are we assuming they're unentangled? Does it matter? Alice's state and Bob's state.
It doesn't really matter. I mean, but it, in terms of a distinguisher who hands inputs to the both the honest parties and to the cheaters, we'd like to handle even a distinguisher who can give them arbitrarily entangled inputs. So we'd like the protocol to make sense and to work with arbitrary inputs, but it's not an explicit part of the formula. Okay. So just some terminology. When I say a protocol with a board, I mean that for example, in cases where a majority of the participants may be cheating, then you can't stop them from the basic denial of service attack where they cause the protocol to stop. And so when I say protocol with a board, it means unfair abort. So the cheaters can abort the protocol based on their outputs. Perfect statistical security, this refers to the quality of the simulation. It's the usual notion of information theoretic security in the perfect case with zero error and zero information leakage. In the statistical case, arbitrarily small error, arbitrarily small information leakage. And then when I speak about computational security, it's against a polynomial time distinguisher and polynomial time intercepts. Yeah.
Quantum?
Yeah.
Quantum polynomial time?
Quantum polynomial.
Yeah. You mean that the two quantum states in the ideal real world are statistically closed? Because, I mean, couldn't it be the case that they're not statistically closed because there's no way to distinguish them because of the measurement collapse issue? Or is
no.
It can't be.
It's a definite. That's the definition of statistically close.
Okay.
Is there a measurement on the end? So in this case, is there a measurement on the entire system? Just like in the classical case where you look at the joint distribution of a bunch of things. So the same thing. Is there a measurement on the entire system which would behave polynomially differently? If so, then that's not secure.
That's equivalent to looking at the L1 norm on the entire state.
So in the classical case, it's equivalent to the L1 norm on probability distribution. In the quantum case, it's equivalent to the L1 norm on the I'm not going to define it.
Okay.
there's an equivalent quantum notion, and if you want to know what it is, I can tell you later. Okay, so what are the basic feasibility results? These slides would be easier to get with animation, but tough luck. What do we know in the classical case? All right, so on the scale here, going from left to right, are protocols that tolerate larger and larger numbers of cheaters. So in the classical case, we know that due to results of, this is BGW, Benor, Goldwasser, and Vigdorsson, Schoen, Kripo, Damgaard. Benor, Goldwasser, and Vigdorsson for the perfect case, you can tolerate n over 3 up to anything, any number less than n over 3 cheaters. And then in the regime where between n over 3 and n over 2, we know that statistically secure computation is possible. That's a result of Rabin and Benor, refined for the case of adaptive adversaries by Kramer et al. Much later. And then in the, but we also know that sort of beyond that n over 3 threshold, perfect multi-party computation is impossible. Okay, and then once we pass n over 2, then we know that basically any kind of computational at all is impossible even with a board. But if we allow a board, then we can get, statistical computation is impossible even with a board. If we allow a board, we can get computational multi-party computation. Okay? Computationally secure multi-party computations. This is a classic result of GMW. All right. So what goes on in the quantum world? Okay, so So let's look at the bottom half first. Let's look at the top half first. So what goes on? So most of these results hold in the quantum world, both the impossibility statements and the and the security of the protocol. So So the BGW CCD style protocols in Rabin Ben Or remain secure against quantum adversaries. The impossibility proofs still hold. The computational protocols are tricky, so the proofs of GMW, the proofs of security of GMW, no longer hold in against quantum adversaries, but there's a sense in which the statement can be rescued by building proofs of knowledge, zero knowledge proofs of knowledge that are good against quantum adversaries.
Are you talking about classical
computation? So this is all, everything above the line is still classical computation. Okay, so now let's look at what happens if I'm interested in computing with quantum data, which is actually what I'm interested in. So a recent result of myself, Ben-Or, Crepeau, Gottesman, and Hasidim shows that statistically secure protocols are possible up to this n over 2 threshold, again assuming classical broadcast. And in an earlier paper with Crepeau and Gottesman, we showed the same result but only up to n over 6, so much weaker statement. But there's an analog to what goes on in the classical case. Perfect security is impossible beyond n over 4. So the thresholds change a bit, but qualitatively things look similar. And these sort of results are what I'll focus on for most of the rest of the talk, to what the extent there's any left. And
let's just put two of
them. Yeah, sure.
Maybe I'll wait.
Okay, so maybe I'll just finish the summary. So in the case where you've got a faulty majority, as before, statistical computational is impossible, even if you allow abort. Okay, that's just a corollary of this. But computationally secure multi-party quantum computation with abort is possible. Okay, again, these two statements here are modulo some assumptions, which I'll talk about later. Yeah, but they're standard computational assumptions. Okay, so Yuval, you had a question. Yeah.
So the functionality is something that has infinite precision. It's like it takes a complex value of the entropy and then returns a complex value.
Yeah, I mean, you can think of it as it's described by some polynomial size. The functionality is described by a polynomial size quantum circuit.
Right, so unless you somehow what's the meaning of talking about the perfectness? You don't have infinite precision in the real world.
The model here is assuming that you can just carry out arbitrarily reliable computations on each machine. So I guess what the sense in which these two models differ is very different from merely sort of discretization or the fact that you get small experimental errors. In the classical case too, you have to take into account that there could be a meteor that lands on your computer while you're doing the computation. Okay, so in that sense, classical computation is always probabilistic. And I think it's the right analog for what you said, actually. Somehow discretization is important, but it's kind of at that level of ideas, and the separation here has this flavor that somehow you're at a different, it's a different type of phenomenon. Okay.
What about perfect NPC for less than N/4?
We don't know any protocols. Open question. My guess is it's possible.
These positive results somehow avoid broadcast.
This picture, I sort of wanted to have one slide which captured what was going on, so I just assumed classical broadcast. Okay, then this picture looks like this. If you don't assume classical broadcast, then there's an additional threshold at n over 3 beyond which you have to allow at least fair abort. Okay, so that's the change, is that without classical broadcast, the picture in this region changes to allow fair abort, and all the possibility results go through, all the feasibility results. Okay, so I'm going to focus on this region here in the picture. So in this paper of with Kripo and Gottesman, we use sort of error correcting, quantum error correcting codes and fault tolerant circuits developed by Aronoff and Benor to give a statistically secure protocol in this region. And the paper was interesting, I mean, technically, but also it was, I would say, the second real proof of security against quantum adversaries. So the first one being the proofs of security of quantum key distribution. And it really required sort of, at the time, what were, mind-bending exercises that in retrospect look much simpler about trying to understand what it means to prove various kinds of statements. In any case, what was clear is that even we got stuck at n over 6, but we felt there was a fundamental barrier at n over 4 due to properties of quantum codes, and I'll try to explain that. And what was later developing techniques for authenticating quantum data gave us more powerful error-correcting codes, and then an idea of reducing quantum computations to classical computations on keys. And those ideas were sufficient to kind of plug these holes and get statistically secure protocols that went up to the and tolerated an arbitrary honest majority. And so for the rest of the talk, I'll try to sort of sketch these ideas. Yeah?
What channels are you assuming?
So I'm just assuming, let's say, for simplicity, secure classical channels, and secure quantum channels, let's say. Those can be implemented under various assumptions, just like in the classical case. Okay, so, so I'll talk now about codes and quantum codes and quantum authentication, and I'll try and explain a little bit about where we got stuck and why.
Why do you need authentication if you have secure channels?
Excellent question. All right, so let's start with a crash course on quantum error correction. So quantum error correcting code is kind of what you'd expect. It's some kind of encoding, takes in, let's say, k qubits and outputs n qubits, or in general, n pieces. And so we're introducing some kind of redundancy in order to tolerate errors. So the property that such an encoding should have is that if few positions of the code are somehow corrupted, that is either erased or changed, then so we pass through some channel that affects some small number of positions in the code word, then after decoding, I should recover the original input state exactly. And this is tricky in the quantum case because of no cloning. In particular, like even for basic feasibility results, a repetition code doesn't work here. You can't, do the obvious thing. So there are no like trivial quantum codes. There are only annoyingly complicated ones. Nonetheless, good codes do exist. So there was a Calderbank and Shor and Steen. Gave a kind of framework for building classical codes based on quantum codes based on classical codes with weird properties, and so they showed that essentially that there exist very good codes. And for the purpose of this talk, it's okay to look only at what happens over large alphabets, and there one can construct codes that correct up to n over 4 errors or up to n over 2 erasures. So this is maybe the things to keep in mind. So the threshold for error correction is n over 4. The threshold for erasure correction is n over 2. Yeah.
What does it mean to corrupt a few qubits? I assume there's some importance taken n qubits. You cannot look at them as n separate qubits.
So it means you can take imagine a channel which worked this way. It gets n quantum systems. N minus t of them are carefully set aside, and t of them are handed to an adversary, and then who operates however he likes, and then you put them all back together and hand them to decoder. So this is what it means: is you've got an operator, a quantum operator that affects only some number of qubits. So it does affect the global state, but there is a notion, well-defined notion of what it means to operate only on a small number of qubits, and it has a physical, the right physical interpretation. Yuval, do you want to share your comment with the whole
group? It's like in a classical probabilistic computation, you can have random bits that are correlated.
Right, okay, yeah, maybe that's a good, yeah, good analogy. Okay, so these thresholds that I just mentioned are basically tight, so quantum codes cannot correct n over 4 or more errors, and I'll try to explain why. So as in the classical case, there's an equivalence between codes which correct t errors and codes which correct 2t erasures. That's the plus one is a mistake. Okay, and the reasoning in the classical case looks like this. If I can correct 2t erasures, then the ball of radius 2t plus 1 around any code word must be empty, or of radius 2t, actually, around any code word must be empty. And in order to correct t errors, I can correct t errors if and only if the balls of radius t around any two code words are disjoint. And these two conditions, you can tell, you know, by just some simple, you know, finger counting type reasoning, are equivalent. Okay. Now the quantum version is more complicated, but it looks a lot like this. So why is that interesting? Well, one thing we can say, and this is a big difference between quantum manipulating quantum information and classical information, quantum codes cannot correct n over 2 erasures. Okay? And so this is because of the, again, the no cloning thing. So what happens, imagine if you could correct n over 2 erasures, you take your code word, you give one half to Alice, you give one half to Bob, they each run the decoder and they get copies of the state. So if you could correct n over 2 erasures, you'd be breaking some rules. And by the first bullet, that means quantum codes cannot correct n over 4 errors. And notice that this whole thing breaks down. It's, none of this is true of classical codes. For, you know, a repetition code in particular will correct n minus 1 erasures and n over 2 errors. Okay, so let's look at a spurious lower bound and try. Now this is where the animation really kind of screws things up, but that's okay. All right, so so a lemma. So let's try and apply this, what we've learned, to multi-party quantum computation and see what happens. Okay, so every multi-party quantum computation protocol which tolerates T cheaters implies the existence of a code which corrects T errors with high fidelity. And if you don't like the word fidelity, think probability. Okay. So what's going on? Well, imagine, all right, it's simpler if you think of verifiable secret sharing instead of general computation. If you think what happens with verifiable secret sharing, it should be that if any set of T people get up and walk away, or if any set of T people submit arbitrary garbage to the reconstruction phase of the protocol, you nonetheless get out the right state with high probability. So every quantum computation protocol tolerating T cheaters implies the existence of a code correcting T errors with high fidelity. And what we concluded in, this is where I need like a piece of paper I can put over the, you know.
Doesn't work.
It's not a slide.
Well, no, I still won't be able to read it. okay, so what we concluded in our first paper was that this must mean that multi-party quantum computation is impossible for T less than N over 4. Okay, and that claim is strictly false. And it's true, but only if you insert the word perfect at the beginning of the sentence. Okay, so perfect multiparty computation is impossible, and that's because perfect quantum error correcting codes cannot correct n over 4 errors. All right, so what's going on? Well, it turns out, you know, once you develop authentication codes, and you can build some kind of approximate versions of quantum codes that break this n over 4 bound. And there's a nice connection to secret sharing. Okay, so basically what breaks down, if I go to the previous slide, what breaks down is this part remains. This statement is very robust. You can't correct n over 2 erasures even with high fidelity or whatever, but the first statement falls apart. In the case where you're interested in only in high probability things. Okay, so let's look at, to understand the construction, let's look at what happens with authenticating quantum messages. So imagine we have two parties, we'll call them Alice and Bob, who want to have this conversation. But the problem is, you know, Alice, you know, she wants to, she has, you know, deep existential doubts about many things. One is, you know, the faithfulness of Bob's love, but the other might be whether or not she's actually talking to Bob at all. Now, you know, we've thought about this problem a lot in the classical world. You know, there's this whole technology of Max and signatures and everything. But what happens if he needs to send her qubits? So unlikely to happen in a phone conversation such as this one, but one can imagine more general situations. So, okay. So we'd like to be able to authenticate the communication between Alice and Bob. And this will be useful to answer Stasha's question. Well, we'll answer Stasha's question, but it'll be useful even in the setting of authenticated channels. Okay, so how do we define authenticating quantum messages? So Alice and Bob share a classical key, K. And you take a state psi. Alice takes some state psi. She encodes it using K, so using some operator A sub K. Okay, and now this is sent over a channel through Eve's hands to Bob. And what we'd like is that the same system behaves kind of like a channel with veto. So Eve is allowed to decide whether or not Bob gets the right thing, but she's offered two options. Either he gets exactly, you know, the right state, or he rejects. And in fact, what we want is the system to behave like this, sort of with high fidelity, with high probability. So Eve, basically, you can think of Eve, actually, she just inputs one bit into some, if you want to phrase this as an ideal functionality, it's in, now by the no cloning theorem, in the conditioned on the fact that Bob accepts, if he accepts with high probability, or with, I mean, non-negligible probability, then Eve should learn nothing. Okay, so there is something weird going on here. There is some difference with classical authentication. So in classical authentication, you can reveal the message, you can stick a tag on it, and the fact that the adversary learns the message doesn't give her any help her at all in changing the authentication tag. What's going on here is a bit different. So here, in order to have any kind of basic authentication functionality for quantum states, then you need to also have secrecy. So in fact, Eve learns nothing ever. I mean, the obvious no cloning statement says Eve learns nothing if Bob accepts. You can strengthen that to show that authentication basically implies encryption of quantum states.
What is Eve's input?
Eve's input? Oh, sorry. Well, I mean, okay, in this picture, let me explain it again. In this picture, Eve just gets the system that Alice is sending to Bob. She plays with it. She changes it. Maybe, she does whatever. She sends it over to Bob. This should behave like an ideal system where there's just some channel and Eve gets veto power over the channel. So she can push a button that says, Bob, you don't learn anything. Bob, you reject. Or she can push the other button that says, Bob, you get the state Alice wanted you to get. But Eve has no other options.
It has the first thing different from just not delivering anything to Bob.
It's the same. I don't know. Maybe, sorry if this is unclear. I'm just saying that this channel, this whole system, should behave like ideal functionality where Eve either lets it go through or says...
So she can only do denial of service.
That's right.
Else.
Is it a one-time thing? Or?
Yeah. Yes. This is a one-time notion.
So you need a key for a different key? For
yeah, well, this is an information theoretically... Well, okay. So you can go... It turns out... Let me answer your question in a second. So it turns out that we were able to construct polynomial time protocols for this problem that are information theoretically secure. And one can authenticate m qubits using some related number of bits of classical key, because you've got encryption, you actually need a fair amount of classical key, about 2m. All right? And I was thinking of maybe going through the construction on the board, but I'm not going to have time. But what I wanted to answer the question about sort of many-time protocols, well, in a computational world, you can always use a generator to generate many bits of key. Similar to the classical.
Sorry, that is encryption involved in
authentication then?
So if you have one
encryption, those both exist. I'm not sure in what sense one would say. Encryption does not apply. I mean, there are quantum encryption protocols that provide no authentication. So, no, the answer, I guess.
No, but in that sense, it's true also for classical. You would come up with
something.
So, what's perhaps surprising is that here authentication does imply encryption.
Every protocol for authentication must imply encryption.
Must encrypt the data.
So, in this way, it's not true.
You can encrypt the sort of there's a quantum analog of a one-time pad that provides no authentication. Okay, so how can we use this tool to kind of get around these bounds on codes? Well, we can come up with a code that somehow corrects in a probabilistic sense integer four errors as follows: start with some erasure correcting code, okay, that corrects up to half of the systems being erased. Now authenticate each piece. Okay, so take the original system, encode it in the erasure correcting code, authenticate each of these pieces using independent keys, and now do some sort of secret sharing plus classical max to authenticate these classical keys. Okay, and now my code, the encoding of my the state phi will be everything in the yellow box. And it'll consist of n pieces, kind of one quantum and one classical per player, if you think of it as a protocol. So this gives us an approximate quantum error correcting code, correcting n over four errors. If any majority of the pieces is untouched, then the original state is recovered approximately. Okay, and this corrects sort of twice as many errors as you could if you were insisted on exact correction. And there is no classical analog in, there's no analog in classical coding theory because of repetition codes, basically. Okay. However, yeah.
Psi is the state of the whole n players.
Psi is just some state that Alice, you know, some dealer, think of it. Maybe the dealer wants to encode a state. So he'll break it into, he'll encode it as follows. He'll encode it with an erasure correcting code and then authenticate each of the pieces of the erasure correcting code. And now basically cheaters, they can because of authentication, they can either cause the decoding algorithm to either ignore a piece or use it. And if the decoding algorithm uses it, then it's close to what it should be. Sorry?
You correct n over 2 errors, no? Because it's n over 2 erasures.
Oh, right. Yeah, sorry. Thanks.
Well, but n over 4 malicious.
No, that's the point. Somehow I just got the... so it's n minus 1. That's not minus a half, okay? Just I don't feel like putting in the parentheses. N minus 1 over 2. Thank you for the typo. Stop with the n minus half. So what's going on? So there's no classical analog to this in codes, but this does smell a lot like secret sharing. Okay, so this is what I just described is almost an exact copy of what is implicitly going on in, say, the Robin Benor computation protocol, or in all, there's millions of papers on so-called perfectly secure message transmission invariants, and maybe not millions, but let's say a dozen, and it's very similar tricks that are going on all the time. So what's going on here seems to have a better analog in secret sharing than in classical coding. So why is that? Well, there's kind of a really good reason for it. So Cleve, Gottesman, and Lowe showed that every quantum code is in fact, or observed, I guess should say, every quantum code is in fact a secret sharing scheme. Okay? And why is it this is, you know, no cloning strikes again? If when I erase some piece of the code, I can recover the state psi exactly, then there's no information in this piece. So what's the lesson of this kind of whole exercise of approximate codes is that, well, these constructions can be best viewed as some kind of robust secret sharing, also called perfectly secure message transmission. And maybe more importantly, secret sharing is the right classical analog of quantum error correction. So what we have is an instance here where sort of viewing things from the cryptographic perspective has given us some insight into some fairly fundamental questions about manipulating information. But this should come as no surprise to this audience, because as we know, cryptography is everything. Yeah.
So I thought I really understood the intuition about why you couldn't have a code and you can't reconstruct information from this half and that half. So
right.
That's
so that's erasure correction. Yeah.
Right. So where does that break down when you?
So that doesn't break down. It's let's go back a couple of slides to.
You're just turning erasure into
error correction. So basically, all that's going on is that this step.
You're turning errors into erasure.
This step of what is called the quantum singleton bound, okay, is fails miserably in the case where. You insist only on approximate reconstruction. That's what's going on.
And it also fails in classical crypto, just as
it fails in classical secret sharing, yeah. So, I mean, the right analog, which was, of course, clear in retrospect, is that is the proof that perfectly secure multi-party computation is impossible for t greater than or equal to n over 3. That's a result about secret sharing. Okay, so I'd like to explain in a few slides. I've got a few more minutes. I'll explain a little bit of how we can use this to build protocols. So in the big picture we had up earlier, we've now sort of zoomed in and are trying to just build this protocol. So the encoding I gave you a couple of slides ago is the basic underlying code. And that somehow what we need to do is operate on encoded secrets. So we need two more tools. One is computing on keys. So what we're doing is we're authenticating data using the authentication codes I didn't show you. And what you can do using these specific codes is you can operate on the classical state. There's a subset of operations you can do on the quantum state, I'm sorry, by changing the classical key. So if you want a trivial example in the classical world, think of the one-time pad. If I've got an encoding of a secret x with a key k, this is just x plus k. Now, I can add 1 to k by playing with the, I can add 1 to x directly by adding something into the encoding, but I can also do it by adding something into the key. And it turns out that in the quantum case, you sort of have to do both. You have to operate both on the encoded quantum state and the classical key. But there are a bunch of operations you can do on the encoded quantum states by basically fiddling with the keys. And fiddling with keys is easier because these are classical objects. And then the other tool we need are some sort of tools for fault-tolerant quantum computing developed mainly by Shor and Aharonov and Ben-Or, and then we have a couple of refinements in this recent paper, but most of the ideas come from those first two papers. One can use, so this, the trick of computing on keys gives you access to some subset of operations called Clifford operations. Doesn't really matter what they are. But the important thing is you can use Clifford operations to verify essentially arbitrary operations. There's some universal set of gates, and you can use the Clifford operations to verify that they were done correctly. Okay, so what you do is you get cheaters to perform the, or get, you know, players to perform these sort of universal gates, and then even if you'll be able to notice if they were done correctly or not using this set of operations that's somehow easier to do. Okay, so you've got some kind of hierarchy of quantum operations, and you somehow are using that. So the overall protocol looks like this. We share our inputs. We do some verification to this, on the secret sharing using sort of Robin Benor style machinery. It's got a few more layers of complexity, but the ideas are more or less the same. And then when we actually do the computation, we reduce the quantum computations to classical computations on keys, and then use classical secure function evaluation protocols to manipulate the keys. Okay, and because all these proofs are happening in the UC framework, it allows us some kind of modular design. And this was pointed out by Benor and Myers in a paper that if you can extend the quantum, the UC framework to make sense in the quantum world. And it basically, the UC framework as it is works. Okay, although, you know, I mean, there's work to do in terms of making sure that's true. But and then at the very end, you distribute the outputs in the kind of the way you'd expect. And a bonus is just like in the case of statistically secure computation, as Talib was speaking about this morning, you get a very straightforward, kind of rigidly structured simulator. This is convenient for the purposes of proving composability. Okay. So what we have is some kind of complete picture of what's going on in the case of what's possible with a robust multi-party computation where a board is not allowed. We got some insights into coding theory along the way, some new tools for fault tolerant computation, and you know, really the idea that just comes back over and over and over, and that I hope was obvious in the talk, was that somehow no cloning is really the single most important thing that changes in this set of tools. And when you want to think about quantum information, this idea of no cloning is somehow, you really want to get a handle on it, and the more you play with it, the more you refine our understanding of exactly what it means. In the second hour of the talk, I'll be speaking about the faulty minority. Okay. All right, so let me just stop here. This talk was meant to is some kind of big picture of cryptography in the quantum world, at least as respect to multi-party computing. Maybe again, the most important point is that the landscape changes, and there are a lot of relatively fundamental questions that are unsolved. I mean, there are a lot of nitty-gritty engineering questions that are unsolved also, but maybe those are less interesting because we don't know exactly what quantum computers will look like. But the fundamental model has been stable for the last 20 years or so, and it makes sense to understand, you know, how should we be thinking about cryptography in this type of world? Okay, so we already know that quantum key exchange is essentially feasible. It's not cheap, but it's feasible. And there's no reason to think at this point that as the power of quantum computers grows, these additional tools we're developing won't somehow be useful. I guess I'll stop there. There were lots of stuff I didn't talk to you about, in particular how you prove anything.